Okay, so I wanted to do a little bit of recap and explanation, because after this past Sunday's class, had a couple of good conversations, but it also gave me a little bit of feedback, and I'm always just kind of reminded that sometimes you may think that something's clear, and it may not always be as clear as you think it is. And just kind of wanted to look at what we're doing big picture. So I want to go over this because it seems like we kind of need to do it. So first of all, this class is really more than anything a class about how to study. Okay, that's ultimately what we're trying to do. I do want to tackle some complex or kind of perplexing passages. And while it is about that, it's really not about that. It's about how to study. And what I mean as far as how to study, not only some techniques and how we go about that, you know, using different translations and words and cross-references and harmonizing, all of that's right. The hermeneutics of how we interpret scripture, all of that obviously is in the category of how we study. But I think there's also something to be said about just attitudes in study. You know, like if you approach a topic, for example, and you already know what the outcome is going to be because that's what you feel comfortable with, that's bad study. Or if you're approaching something and it's not what you're reading or what you've heard is not what you've heard before, and that makes you nervous, and so therefore you shy away from that and you just go back to what makes you feel comfortable, that's a problem. My hope is that every topic that we discuss will challenge us as individuals. I found myself smiling this past week as I was working on lesson number 4. Like, I just can't wait to get into it. It's the whole study is only going to be around 2 verses. But I've never, from a minister standpoint, have actually walked through with a group of people exactly how my mind is working. You just have the fruit of that. And so I found myself, number one, smiling because I'm going, this is going to be really cool because they'll see how crazy I am now whenever I'm studying on my own. You know, maybe it'll be helpful. But the other thing is I'm smiling because I'm going, this is going to make some people uncomfortable, I think, because the implications of if this is in the interpretation of these passages, what do I do with that? And I'm grinning because I'm like, guess what? They're going to have to join me in this uncomfortableness. They're going to have to go through this with me. And so that's what I'm trying to do. Now, let me back up to last week, because I think I enjoyed last week's discussion, but I think there ended up being a little bit of confusion. So our first topic is looking at Romans chapter 4 with Colossians 2. We're going to discuss how circumcision is used in Romans chapter 4, and how baptism and circumcision is used in Colossians chapter 2. We're going to compare and contrast and harmonize the text, because we have friends of ours that say, listen, we believe that in Romans chapter 4, whenever it talks about Abraham being considered justified before God before he was circumcised, and then when adding to that Colossians 2, where circumcision is compared with baptism, we therefore conclude that one is justified before God, saved, that is, before he is baptized. But see, what I did at the beginning of class was I was just trying to illustrate a point. I was asking you to prove to me that baptism is essential for the forgiveness of sins. I really did that just to warm us up, but it ended up going on longer than I intended. That's okay, but I just wanted to tell you, we're not typically going to do that with every topic. It just fit for this topic. I was trying to make a point that, see, you and I believe that baptism is for the forgiveness of sins. Not everyone agrees with us, as you know, and they have rebuttals to all of that. If I were not a member of the church, if I was a member of what you typically see in the Protestant movement, Why am I not going to go to passages on baptism whenever I talk about salvation? Anyone? Kelly?
I would think you would because of another passage you'd be comfortable with.
Okay. Maybe, and that could be true, but it also could be...
Or you don't think they're relevant.
I mean, when we're talking at the end of the day about how someone is saved, I'm not going to jump to baptism because while I think that baptism is commanded and it's got beautiful symbolism behind it, what I need to stress to you is that you need to put your faith in Jesus because salvation comes by faith and faith alone. Okay? So if I get into baptism, see, I'm distracting you. But through that conversation, I think it kind of confused everyone. Like, hey, what are we doing in this study? So that's my apologies. We're just getting back to the task at hand. Now, there's one more thing that I wanted to I'm going to request of you, and I want you to take this in the spirit in which it's intended, which is to be helpful. I have a general rule for myself. Whenever I'm in one of your classes, we have so many good teachers here. Kelly, after me, is going to be teaching through Revelation, and I want you to really commend him because that's a meaty study, okay? And that can be an intimidating one to cover. And by the way, some of you have never been in one of Kelly's classes. He does a very good job in his classes, so I'm looking forward to that. But let me say something. Whenever I'm in someone's class, I typically try not to make more than one or two comments. And here's why. Number one, because I talk too much and it's a good opportunity for me to learn how to be quiet. And I'm laughing, but I'm kind of not joking. But the other reason is because I'm trying to give other people an opportunity to join the discussion. I'm going to ask something, and this is going to sound bizarre, but here's my request. If you have a question, you ask as many questions as you want to ask in this class. But I'm going to ask that you join me in my personal challenge. If you just have a comment, would you please keep that to one or two per class period? And here's why I'm asking you that. And even if you're someone like me, like whenever... the teacher's asking a question, I want to answer a lot. And it's not because I'm trying, it's exciting, I want to answer. And I'm trying to limit myself on that. The reason why I'm asking this is because there are some of you that are really timid about talking in class. And I'm going to kind of put you on the hot seat. Because see, part of this process is finding a voice. And it's finding your own voice. And it's finding how to think through topics. And so I may tell someone if they've already commented or they've been answering, I may say, hey, I'm going to ask that someone else comment. And it may get awkward in here for a while. And I'm just going to let it get awkward until people start talking. Do you understand why I'm doing this? What are you afraid of? Do you know how many times, like Rod, when he'd be in his class, or maybe Joel was teaching just one of you men, you'll ask a question, I'll just pop off an answer, and then I just had it wrong. And I'm laughing. I'm like, Kelly and Jennifer probably heard that. That's awkward. Well, it is what it is. So here's the thing. I get it. You don't want to be the guy, hey, who built the ark? Moses. Loser. No. But here's the thing. You don't know all Bible, and I don't know all Bible. And you've not thought through everything, and I've not thought through everything. So let's get over ourselves. Don't be afraid of sounding ignorant. We're all ignorant in somewhere in the Bible. I promise you that. So if I'm saying, hey, I'm going to move on to someone else, do not take that personal. Do y'all understand where I'm coming from? Thank you for your patience with that. But my hope is that you're really going to enjoy these studies. Now, having said all that, I know some of you are so scared that you're like, yeah, I hear you. I'm not going to say a word. And I get it. And there's nothing I can do about that. So, but I tried. I'm trying. Okay, so here's our run through very quickly. Again, we went through Romans 4. The argument, I've already expressed what the argument is. Romans 4 with Colossians chapter 2. I'm not going to walk you through Romans 4 again. Okay? But the bottom line is that I'll sum it up this way. Paul is simply making the point that justification before God which is totally needed because we, none of us can justify ourselves. We all fell short. Comes from a belief in God. A belief in God. Now, does belief mean that you're obedient? Yes, but that's not his point. That's not his point. He's speaking to an audience that is struggling with a couple areas. It is by works of the law that you are justified, and in particular, the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation are saved by works of the law. And Paul says, no, everyone is saved through faith in Jesus. Which, by the way, is the reason why most of our brethren, the Jewish nation, are condemned. And the Gentiles are coming in. And that's Romans chapter 11 for you. But to make this point, because see, this is his roots. He knows the Jewish mind. He knows how the Jews will think. So what he does, he goes, I'm going to bring up two heavy hitters to prove my point. Abraham, Father Abraham, was not justified by works of the law. He believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Remember, Jewish brethren, whenever God made a promise to Abraham, and Abraham believed God. Okay, Lord, and by the way, in that context, and let's not run from this, was there any act of obedience in the traditional way of what you think of act as obedience, whenever he just believed God? I mean, at the moment, he's just believing in God. There's nothing for him to do. Abraham, I'm going to bless you. Okay, Lord, I believe you. That's a righteous son right there. And then he goes to David. Blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven. We wanted to point out the point of sins. He says that that passage is evidence that one is not justified by works of the law. How is that passage, blessed is one whose sins are forgiven, against whom the Lord does not count iniquity? How does that prove anything? Because we're dealing with sin. And he's just saying, blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven, whenever God doesn't count iniquity. He doesn't bring any concept about works of the law bringing about that salvation. He's just saying, oh, God bless those that are forgiven by God. And then he circles back around to Abraham and he says, and I got a question because I'm not done with Abraham yet. Was he justified before or after circumcision? Paul says before. So there's his case. That's Romans 4. Okay, so here's where we were at last week. Again, did the old law discuss a kind of spiritual circumcision? If you remember, allow me not to go back over that, but just to answer that. Yes. Yes. I understand that circumcision is first brought up in Genesis 17, but Moses will talk about a circumcision, and he'll play off a concept that I don't want you to cut away from the foreskin of the genitalia, but of your heart. And in that context, for example, the Deuteronomy, like your stubbornness and your sinful ways, would you cut that out? Would you cut it out? Side note, this idea of this Old Testament God and this New Testament God, this idea of the people, the old, God was just expecting them to follow law and it wasn't about the heart, that's not biblically correct at all. The old law is a very grace-filled time because God's always been graceful. And God has always wanted people to have an authentic walk with him written on tender hearts. It says that, brethren, in the old law. Okay, we established that. Now, I'm going back to you. Are we talking about, in Romans chapter 4, are we talking about baptism or physical circumcision? Okay, I heard physical circumcision is what I heard. Now, listen. I want you to think about this. If you were reading this passage, would you, and this doesn't mean that you couldn't reference it, but just the passage alone, if you read this, is there anything in the passage that would make your mind cross-reference to a baptism? Romans 4. Okay, you're saying no. Dusty's saying maybe. What are your thoughts, Dusty?
Well, as the argument goes in principle, right, you have this act that the Jews saw identified them as one of God's children, and you could substitute
Let me ask you this then. And see, this is what I love the fact that we have one guy saying no, another guy's going kind of, this is good. Are you saying that because you have Colossians 2 in mind, a passage like that? Or are you saying, I'm just saying whenever I read about a principle of here was this pretty significant moment in one's life, it just makes me think of baptism.
Really, I'm just speaking from kind of the other side of the argument. I'm not sure that I would find that in this passage, but I can see how someone see those things or kind of
similar. So are you saying too that it could be because their mind is also has in mind a Colossians 2 kind of passage? And so what I'm hearing, and I'm not trying to make any point, by the way, we're just talking this through. What I'm hearing Dusty say is that it does sound like you're more in agreement with Britt. I probably, if I just read this passage alone, would not have thought of baptism. But thinking about the other side, and being familiar with Colossians 2, I can definitely see why they would cross-reference. And I would assume, Britt, you wouldn't disagree with that if you took Colossians 2 in mind.
I'm looking at it strictly from the context of the two verses in Romans.
Strictly from that context.
If we agree that it's about physical circumcision, because if there would have been any precursor in the verses before or after that said something about the spiritual aspects of circumcision, then I would agree with Dustin.
Yeah.
Because then it's trying to send you down that path as to how the two types are positioned.
We've got a thread. We've got a connecting.
Yeah, and I just don't see that in those two verses.
Sure. Let me get Reagan first. I think it's all her hand, and then Billy.
I was just going to say, Dusty used the word principle, but I would use the word theme. Like, I can see the theme of, in the Old Testament, having faith and being circumcised, and then in the New Testament, we see a theme of believers believing and being baptized. So without like a distinct cross reference, I do see the theme, and specifically verse 13, which talks about becoming like heirs through the righteousness. You know, we have that same language in the New Testament of being heirs through Christ, through God. So there's language around this discussion that does pull on themes that does make me, you know, I think because I know that like it is coming from that, but again,
yeah.
Well, and that,
right.
Well,
and here, so here's what I appreciated about Reagan's comment, because there's a tricky thing that just happened here, and I can't tell you what it is, and I don't even know if Reagan can tell you, but she's more in the seat to tell you what's going on. She's like, I don't think it's from these other ones. Granted, I've been thinking about this, and so it's like, if you just read Romans 4, you know, like I know, like when I'm doing a book study, I get locked in on the theme because there's typically a theme. There's a place where the author's going. And I try my hardest to stay locked in and not get sidetracked because, you know, Paul will do that. He'll come over here and then you get back in. It's so important to keep that thread. And so that's the question. Like, if you just kept to the thread line, would a person even think of baptism? But Reagan's going like, I don't know though, even without Colossians 2, like being heirs, you know, what I have thought now, well, being an heir of God, one is baptized. Of course, a little bit of the irony of that is that you and I believe that we have to be baptized to be heirs. They don't. And so do you also see how this gets tricky? Because see, once you hear things, it just becomes a part of your study, but you can't not hear things. Does this make sense? You can't protect yourself from every thought out there. So what I'm just trying to say is, welcome to Bible study, because here I am saying, hey, I want you to think about these passages. Well, now it's kind of hard to get Colossians 2 out of your head. And so we're trying, all of us, our best to continue to stick to the context and honor the thread, but also not be naive. And so what Reagan's going is like, I don't know, though. Is there some theme here that you could cross-reference? Let me get Billy and then Kelly. I appreciate this. I'm just talking this through with you guys.
So as you've already laid out, there's this issue, and then there's a big issue, how to study.
Right.
And so we know that we have to be very cautious about just seeing the phrase and then tying that every other time that phrase is used in the Bible. That
Can I give an example really quick? I'm just picking on this a little bit. So sometimes we'll talk about comparing Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3, seeing and make melody in your heart, right? But one passage says, let what fill you? Yeah, so one's the Spirit, and what's the other one? One's the Word. Well, do we look at those and we go, to have the Spirit in you is the Word? Or are they totally different? Like, that's one thing that we have to do. So sometimes we're looking at phrases that are different but similar, and we're trying to figure out if one is explaining the other. But then Billy's pointing out, sometimes you have a phrase that is literally the same phrase, the same phraseology somewhere else. And we conclude then that since it's the same phraseology, it always has that same meaning. The problem is that's not the case.
And you're going to get into the next lesson, this is a phrase, you know, the sons of God.
Right.
Well, sometimes that's men who are godly, and sometimes that's literally angels. So you have to
look at the context. Had something specific in mind.
Once you've established a principle, and sometimes a person needs to be rebaptized.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a person loses grace. That should then allow us to say, well, this passage is dealing with more than what it's just dealing with.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All of these things are difficult, which is why we have to constantly be studying. We have to constantly be talking it through with other Christians. We have to constantly be open to the idea that we may have been wrong about
Yes.
And things are more complicated than we sometimes want them to be.
And again, and that's the point of this class. That's why we're going to be doing this, right? So even with what he said, there's a lot more that could be said on that. Like, there's principles. Like, sometimes a principle can go too far. Also, you have to listen. Where I'm at, bottom line is, you have to know the topic more in totality, and you got to harmonize it. That's the end of the whole thing. And then here's the thing: you got to be humble enough to realize you may have missed a passage. You may have missed a passage or a concept. Okay, let me do this because I'm loving this, but I realize we have 10 minutes left in this class, and I just thought for sure we'd finish this one today. So let me move this along, if I may. Okay. Why is this important to knowledge? We've actually been talking about this. So the context and the thread is important. It's important because we need to make sure that we're understanding what the author was intending. You can understand what an author was trying to, the point an author is trying to make. Does it take Bible study? Sure. Does it take close attention? Yes. But you can follow a thread. Whenever we can honor this, see, there's a thing that we have to do. Just because I'm more in the camp of, I think if I were just to read Romans 4 and follow the thread, baptism would not come to mind. Now, you can talk about themes later on, and I could say, yeah, I could understand that, but I'm going to go to bat, though, at the end of the day, once we, and I think like Reagan would too, once we start getting into this discussion, in other words, we can acknowledge the cross theme, but as Bible students, we'll start to tighten those reins, though, once we get into Romans 4. Then we can look at other passages and see if it's appropriate to harmonize them. We discussed that. Did you have to be circumcised if you were descendant of Abraham? Who had to explain in full the background and meaning of circumcision? So could someone kind of sum that up? Kelly? And allow me to, I was just using this as a springboard. I'm kind of assuming.
It's interesting because when God gave the command, he read in, I can't remember what the Genesis is, but it was to his descendants. And then in Galatians chapter 3, he talks about those who are heirs, who are the seed of Abraham.
Right.
I don't think those two are the same thing.
No, and so just really quickly too, because we got 10 minutes. So in Genesis 17, who? It's the descendants. Okay, now, this is males. Males only. On the eighth day, and you don't have a say-so in this. Whenever Paul is referencing circumcision, he's dealing more with the literal circumcision that they would have understood. Now, they understood, though, it doesn't mean that not everyone could be considered righteous before God. You cannot circumcise a female. So just because I'm breaking down the literal side of that, the Jewish nation understood everything we're talking about, and they understand that the point that Paul is making, okay? But I do want us to remember that, because see, the problem is whenever you start comparing circumcision to baptism and you're trying to go literal, like how Paul was trying to use it versus how it's using in Colossians 2, you could end up finding yourself in a pickle. Now, in Colossians 2, and we'll kind of explain this. Listen, if we don't finish today, that's okay, but let's at least get into it. Let's move over to Colossians 2. But I think we can at least agree that his main point in the context was a physical circumcision, one that they were familiar with. Okay, Colossians chapter 2. I kind of put just a summary here, if you'll allow me to read this as you're turning over there. Has a wonderful introduction, reminds the saint in Colossae that Gentiles were also richly blessed in Christ Jesus. That was his goal, was to bring the gospel to them at all, warning and teaching all with wisdom in order to present everyone mature in Christ. Okay, this is what he's writing to them about. He then encouraged them not to be deceived by philosophy or empty deceit, those that are troubling them. And he taught them that in Christ, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. He's making all these points. We come to our text in Colossians chapter 2. And again, I'm also going over this. Hopefully you've read through this. Here we are, verse 11. In him, that is Christ, also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith and the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. And you, who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses, by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. Let me work that backwards. Jesus Christ triumphant was over everyone, even the dark powers. I do not believe that Colossians chapter 2, we can talk about this later, is talking about the doing away with the old law, not this passage. I believe this one he's talking about is the record of debt, that is the sin. Jesus took all the, if you will, the IOUs that we owe Jesus, and he nailed them to the cross. That, I think, in context, is what he's talking about. We sometimes riff references to the old law, not persuaded that your Ephesians passage. Let me continue to work backwards. He's talking about what God worked, the powerful working of God, whenever we were baptized. Whenever we were baptized in Jesus Christ, this was a baptism made without hands, and it is compared to circumcision. Everyone clear on that? Again, hoping you've read through this. All right. Questions. Who seems to be the main audience of this letter? Now, that one, you had it in your outline for the week. But if you didn't, for time, let me just say this. It seems to be we definitely have a Gentile audience. I would never say there's no Jews involved. But these passages in here definitely seems he's pulling to a Gentile audience. Now, does that mean, though, that Paul never uses Old Testament language? Well, of course not. But we have a Gentile Jewish nation. Seems to be primarily a Gentile group here. Are we considering a physical circumcision? So here's my question. Are we considering a physical circumcision? All right, let me hear someone else. Why? Huh? This is a physical circumcision, Jordan says, that is made without hands. Oh, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, you said physical.
Sorry, yeah. She said a spiritual circumcision because it's made without hands. You can't be talking about a physical circumcision. It needs hands. Fair enough? Now, again, was Paul in Romans 4 talking about a physical circumcision? Here, it's clearly spiritual. Romans 4, it's clearly, okay? Are we comparing apples to apples? Let me throw out another one. Why bring up circumcision? I mean, that's a fair question to ask. Then why is he bringing up circumcision? I'm not going to answer this for you, brother. I get to take the lazy way out now. Now I just get to dump it all on you. Let me get Kelton and I'll come back to Reagan. Yes, sir.
Is it because it's a correlation? Not necessarily that it's the same thing, but a correlation? That circumcision and baptism be used in the same context? I don't know, that's just my thought.
And no, let's go down that. And if he did, what would be the correlation? Okay.
I mean, not just saying it's just an act, but it takes the person to want to do it.
Okay.
That they want to be circumcised, they want to be baptized.
Ooh, now that's interesting. So can I play off this a little bit? So you and I can now agree that there is a spiritual concept of circumcision here because we've established that it's made without hands. We also agree that now he is making a comparison between baptism and circumcision because the author has made the comparison, right? Yet there are some things that don't totally compare with circumcision and baptism. One of them, when you were circumcised as a Jew, did you want to do that, Kelton?
No, because it was required.
You're only how many days old? And also, if you're female, there is no circumcision. Of course, you're supposed to understand this. Was he saying that females can't be saved? What is he saying, that now baptism is something that you don't do on your own? No, he's not saying that. So he is making comparison, and he's pulling off of different aspects. Then what aspect of circumcision, you know, I'm just talking this out loud with you. What is it about circumcision then that he wants to connect to baptism? A demonstration of faith. Okay. Let me get Kelly. Sorry, I'm seeing hands go up. Kelly?
He's talking about it. The way I read this Colossians 2 is that cutting away the old man, is that slicing off getting rid of that old life. That's what I see.
Yes, so I agree with you. When you were circumcised, though, physically circumcised under the Jewish system, was there symbolism behind that? What did it represent?
A covenant.
Now, let me ask you this. Were you commanded to be circumcised under the old law? Could you be right before God if you weren't circumcised?
No.
You want to start comparing? We can start comparing. Do you see the point I'm trying to make here? I can start comparing. And if I start comparing now, because I know the ways that I can't compare circumcision based on the principles of faith, and the only things that I'm left with now to compare it to is that it is something that represented a covenant with God. It is something that everyone can do. It is the cutting away of your stubbornness and your fleshly lives. And it is it's also commanded. So here's the thing. Whenever you're talking about Abraham, I got no problem with God justifying Abraham before he was circumcised. And I'm going to say something right now. God can justify whoever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants. I don't have any say-so in that. But I'm trying to figure out, as a Christian, what do I understand? What do I believe? What do I teach? And what do I preach? So now in this context, the reins are being pulled in, not because of my bias towards baptism, because the context won't allow it. He's pulling in now on a spiritual concept of circumcision. This is whenever you come into covenant with God. This is whenever you're cutting away your stubbornness and your flesh. And also, I think he is pulling off very clearly now, not the Romans 4 thought process, but this is what signifies a child of God. If you're one of Abraham's descendants and you lived after the first circumcision, you were commanded to be circumcised. Okay, so the last question and then we're done. Who was doing the work in baptism? Thank you. It is baptism is an act of faith. Does all this make sense? Maybe I rush this. Here's the thing. Next week, we're going to get into Genesis chapter 6. But if you had thoughts or questions and you're going, hold on, time's out. I want you to say something. So next week, I'm going to open it up and be like, hey, any more thoughts or the closing comments? But that's why I'm seeing Colossians 2 and Romans 4 in context. I totally understand why people cross-reference them. Matter of fact, pretty powerful. I just can't, as a Bible student, when I'm looking at the context, get those things to harmonize the way they're trying to get them to. Not because I don't want to, just because the context is just not allowing it. Does that make sense? Ooh, man. I feel like I rushed that last part. I'm going to pick up with questions last week, and then we'll get into Genesis 6. Yes, it is.